Hello again, everybody, and welcome. This is Julie Knudsen with the podcast Turning the Pointing Labrador. And this will be episode number 68. They're just mounting up. And this one is going to be two parts. One, as I mentioned before, we're going to talk about forming a training plan for the second half of the season for people who want to go at the master level in the American Pointing Lab Association. Whether you're going for your very first blue ribbon master pointing retriever, or you're sitting there working on two or three or four time, whatever it is. So just kind of a training plan. We'll just discuss some of the approaches to that so that you can, ideally start before now, but starting now, be ready when the September and October tests all come in. It's really nice. It's a terrific feeling to feel like you've done everything you can and you feel pretty solid about your dog. That doesn't mean necessarily you're going to pass, but it certainly means you've done everything you can to make sure your part of the deal is taken care of. Because there's weather and conditions and bird behavior and weird circumstances and somebody's dog running in the middle of your test and all kinds of funny things that can happen over which you have no control. So all you can do is do everything you can to get your dog and yourself, equally important, ready. So we're going to talk about at least the beginnings at this point, how you go about being ready for the fall and maybe being successful and getting some of those purple, blue and purple ribbons the way you'd like. The other part of this, and the first part, is I'm going to go back because of some questions and some issues that continue to come up with regard to puppy raising. And I'm not going to address so much bird introduction and all that for the pointing guys. I'm just going to talk about puppies and general behavior and some of the problems that people seem to have without actually being aware that they do have a problem. So I'm going to begin with that because, you know, if you raise a puppy well and with the long-term goal in mind, it makes a tremendous difference on how easy your entire program and life with the dog is. If, on the other hand, you get a puppy and it's just fun and the kids love it and it's so cute and it does these tricks and the neighbors want to see it and it becomes this form of entertainment for you and many other things they become kind of a... I don't even know the words for it, but sometimes these dogs occupy roles in our lives that we don't really we're not fully aware of, and we don't really define, but it's very much there. And so they take on a role of, you know, the one thing that really loves you unquestioningly. If your partner doesn't, you know, darn them, but this dog does, so the dog's awesome, so you put all your positive energy into the dog and not so much into the other people around you. There's a lot of stuff like that happens, but to admit that is pretty tough to do. So there's a lot of funny little things that go on between puppies and the person that has primary responsibility for training them. So I just want to say again, as I have so many times, you know, in everything I've written and all the podcasts I've given, is that 8 weeks to 6-7 months can make all the difference in the world. Now, everyone who gets a little 8-week-old puppy, right, there's no such thing as an ugly 8-week-old puppy. And I don't care whether you're getting a Lhasa Apso, a wiener dog, one of my favorite of all times, or, you know, a retriever or a pointing dog or a big hunting dog or just a working dog, a cattle dog, whatever you're getting, whatever kind of dog, that is extremely important. It's somewhat roughly equivalent to the time that when you bring a human infant home until about junior high school. You know, by that time, a lot of things are kind of set. And the way they think and the way they see themselves and the way they see the world, a human child, is very, very set. And so you spend the rest of the teen years and adult years and all that based off of that foundation. And it is so very true for dogs and for puppies. And people don't disagree with that. Nobody argues, oh, that's not true. But I'm not sure that people are always aware of exactly what the pieces of that are for a puppy. And I'll just give some examples. A lot of people, especially if they buy the book, Training the Pointing Labrador, which the beginning part of that, again, I don't care if you have a Lhasa Apso, a Rat Terrier, a Mastiff, the early puppy stuff is really important. The nature of your interaction, it needs to be based on mutual respect. And preferably if every dog that everybody ever got could take the walk every day, I know how life makes that not possible sometimes, but if you don't live somewhere where you can do that, I don't know, having a dog, is it that good? But anyway, if you could put your little puppy down on a safe place and take off across natural conditions where there's not going to be attacked by something or run over by something or swarmed by school children, and they could do that every day, it teaches your dog so many things. It teaches your dog to stay with you, to focus on you, that running off is not, they don't learn running off. They don't learn ignoring you. They learn the exact opposite. They don't learn the bad things, and they learn all the good stuff, which basically is to remain connected with you, to feel that you are the alpha dog in the group, and to do the best they can to hang with you and learn what it is you're providing for them to learn. So people love to do that, especially my retriever people. And the dog stays with you, right? And they don't run off, and it's great. So then, when they do that, you never put a leash on them. So it's just easier because they stay with you, so you don't need it. And then when you do put a leash on them, they get all crazy, right? So let's just take this off and because I don't really need it. And then you wind up with an equivalent of a teenage dog that's never had to walk with you on a leash in your life. I don't know why anyone would do that. I think that's a terrible, terrible thing, assuming that your dog is going to have to, at different points in its life, be on a leash with you, walking to the vet or walking to the line or walking to the vehicle or walking down the street. They're going to have to be on a leash. If, you know, young dogs, 3 months old or taught, you know, sometimes you have things around your neck and you have a leash and then you walk with me when they're little, and they can't really resist, it's not very hard, and it takes a day or two or three, and then it's pretty good. And then after that, you can teach them to walk without pulling. That's a terrific thing. So what I've gotten in for training over the past couple years, which is different from what it used to be, I get a lot, when people go to their local puppy training classes, addition to all the food that makes everything so much easier that they give them, now I understand that they put harnesses, especially on the field dogs. They put harnesses on them, and then you hook your leash onto the top of the harness by their withers, on their shoulders, and then basically they can pull wherever they want, but you're not choking them to death, and you know, at least you can get around. I can't think of a worse thing to do. I can't, other than a gentle leader. That's the only worst thing to do with a dog. I mean, if we're going to do some Iditarod training, because we're going to go be doing pulling sleds in the snow, I'd say snap a harness on there and teach them to pull like heck wherever they want to go. But if that's not going to be what they do for a living, that's the last thing I would put on a dog. It's not very hard to put something around their neck, and preferably, not a flat collar, maybe on a little tiny dog, when they get a little bit older, something that has a kind of a squeeze and release, so you don't choke them, but you can impact them with a little bit of training pressure that they don't want repeated. But the young dogs should be taught to walk on a leash. And I didn't say they should be taught to pull you like heck on a leash. They can be taught to walk on a leash. And if it's difficult for you, don't go to the local training store where they give you your bag of bacon bits and you bribe the dog into doing things for you because you're going to feed them. If you're going to have this dog for the rest of your life and have it be a partner and a pleasant thing, then you're going to have to figure out how to teach the dog, you have to walk next to me. And I'm not going to bribe you any more than I would bribe my, you know, I'm married. I'm not going to bribe my husband. Listen, I'll wash your truck if you don't go out and have affairs with women every day. That's not going to, I'm not going to do that. The deal is I do my part, you do your part. And it's the same thing with dogs. They need to walk next to you because that's their job. And it's not too difficult on a 12-week and a 14-week and a 15-week-old puppy. So get it done then. And in doing that kind of thing, you are teaching the dog that you are the alpha dog, that there are some expectations in the life of this dog that it may not think are the most fun thing in the world, like walking on a leash and paying attention to your speed and direction and pace. But you still have to do it. So if you teach a little guy, there's going to be a whole set of expectations, not ridiculous, you know, just like a human infant. You know, they don't make them do algebra problems when they're 4 years old. They can't. But you might make them pay attention to you when you speak to them. You know, you might make them wear clothes when they go outside. So there's expectations for living things that are reasonable and appropriate. And if you can, on a young puppy, teach them, there's some stuff you're going to have to do. And that's that. Then they will take on that same attitude. They won't view it as some terrible thing. But when I get dogs in that have never been made to do anything they don't want. And the dog is shocked and I'm shocked. We're both shocked. I mean, I'm looking at them going, how did you get this far this way? And they're looking at me like, you are the meanest lady I've ever seen. Okay, I'm very sorry for the dog, because the dog's going to have to suffer because its raisers and trainers did not think it was worth taking the time to teach the important things. And I get them, because then I'll just pay somebody else to do it. But again, then the dog is the one that has to make all the adjustments, and the people who wouldn't bear down and figure out how to do it don't. You know, and that's just not fair. And then that dog doesn't have a lot of respect for them and has a lot more for the real trainer. And I would avoid that too if I had a little puppy. So teach dogs that there are expectations. Now, I don't think that a 12-week-old dog should be steady if you're retrieving, and should heal and shit and be a robotic thing, because they don't really get that, and that there's time for that. But they should walk with you. If you say sit, they should sit. You shouldn't ask things that aren't appropriate of a tiny puppy, but you should teach. Most important, it isn't that the heel and sit stuff is what I'm talking about. Teach them, I'm going to show you stuff I need you to do, and you need to do it. And I'm going to make sure that you do, and then you follow through, and this is how our relationship is. So that's a great thing to do. And the other part of that, and this is real important, when you're going to teach a dog, whatever it is, you know, don't go running through the door in front of me. Don't knock the cat out of the way when you're going somewhere. Don't chase a cat. Don't chase the other. Don't bite dog's ears. All of that stuff, they can learn. Figure out how to stop it. Don't wait. Don't bribe them. Teach them, hey, don't do that. If I came to your house and bit everybody's ears and you'd kick me out. So same thing with the dog. Don't let them do obnoxious, dumb stuff. Nobody likes that, and you're teaching them, you get to do whatever you want, and you should feel comfortable and happy all the time. And that's not true. Sometimes you have to just toe the line and do what you're supposed to do to fit in to the system of our lives. So what people do, when they're going, okay, I get that. I can make the dog do this and that and this and that. And the problem is, and people do this with their kids too, is, okay, so I've taught my dog has to walk on a leash and stop and sit. So here's one of the things they do. So you took it for a walk around the neighborhood or out in the open space or something, and you came back and have the leash on and you're walking up to the gate. And the very microsecond that leash comes over their head and off, boom, they're free. Okay? Boom, they're free. Leash came off, free, go do whatever you want. So the behavior only applies when the thing is around your neck. And when it's not around your neck, it doesn't. You do that 3 or 4 times and you have taught that dog that the minute a leash comes off their head, the rules are gone. And there's no place where that is useful. And there's a lot of places people do that kind of thing. So if you have a little puppy and you're doing the leash work, yay, you know, and you come in, all right, and you sit down, and let's say you're in your backyard, so you're safe. They can't run into the street or something. And you take them, you have them sit down, and you take this little guy, right, 12 weeks old, 13 weeks old. You take the leash off after they've been sitting. Keep them seated. Do not associate leash off, you're free. it's a leash off, and now you're sitting, and I'm telling you how great you are. In a second, I'm going to say okay, or whatever your release is, and then I'm going to let you go. There are so many small things like that. Because how many of you have an adult dog where the minute the collar comes off or the leash comes off, whoop, they're gone. And again, there's no usefulness for that. It'd be nice if you could take their training gear off. And then when you're ready, okay, now we're in the yard or it's okay. So, all right, now you can move freely. There's a lot of things that people teach little puppies. It's cute, you know, when they're 12 weeks old and when they're 8 months old. And they, the minute you take the leash off, they shake it off, knock, hit you with the leash and run out the door. And it's just real obnoxious. So when you do the small things with the dog, these little guys, it would be very good if you were aware of it. Some of the other small things with these dogs that are real important, and I run into this a lot, particularly with the ladies for some reason, but not always. But so they're doing the basic obedience on their little 12-week-old, you know, 16-week-old dogs. They're doing that, and they're trying to be really good dog people. And maybe the first time they've done it, or maybe the 20th time they've done it. And the dog sits and then leans up against them. Oh, who doesn't like that, right? Oh, this dog really loves me. It just wants to lean up against me. So you teach this dog that anytime you heel and set, it has to be when you're in direct contact with each other. So now direct contact is the way that we do basic obedience. And again, there's no place where that's going to be useful for you. Direct contact after, you know, in first it's a kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling. Oh, look how much they like me. Oh, they're nervous. This makes them feel better. Let's just say if I came to your house and I was going to work with you and your dog, and when I was doing it, I leaned up my head on your shoulder every time. I think you'd get sick of that about first or second time. Like, don't do that. We're working. Don't lean on me. Let's just do our work. It's the same way with the dogs. Leaning on you is some other thing. And it's different things for different dogs. Some of them are insecure. Some of them are just kind of being manipulative. Some of them like it better than not leaning on you. It doesn't really matter why they do it. They need to not lean on you. Because when you're hunting, you don't want a dog that's interacting with your feet or your lower legs. Not good. If you're moving through a field, if you're sitting in a blind, if you're running an event, if you're walking down the street, contact with you is not in your best interest. They should be a nice couple, several inches away, comfortably moving at the same speed. But people teach little dogs, they, you know, let the little pippy lean, and then they're sitting crooked on their hips, which we've discussed in depth is very bad for their structure. And then they're leaning on you, and it just grows into a big problem. And a lot of times until somebody points it out, nobody even recognizes it. So that's another little thing, just like taking the leash off and you're done. And every time you sit, just lean on me. Those are things which grow into problematic things later on. That would be very good if you taught the dog from the very... Never teach that to the dog. Teach them exactly what it is you want. And leaning is not a part of that. Just like taking the leash off doesn't mean go wild and crazy, etc. Another part for the retrievers, right? When they bring something back, do not, no matter how enthusiastic retrievers they are, do not teach them that the minute I take that thing from you, whether it's out of your mouth or you throw it on the ground, the minute I do that, head out, I'm going to throw another one. The only time you get the wild, crazy stuff like that, like get in and throw it again, is if you have a dog with a moderate or low interest, then you do whatever you can to kind of get them fired up. If you have a dog that does have a good interest, again, let's don't let them learn stuff we don't want them to. Let's have, you know, when I take whatever you're retrieving from you, then you need to wait to see what happens next. Don't just go ripping out there. When I get dogs in for training, I can tell you what direction, but on the second day, what direction, how that person threw it, threw whatever they threw, and what direction relative to whatever their body was facing, where they threw, and how far they would throw, and how high. I can tell that because the dog, you know, just through pattern and habit, has done the same thing over and over again. So they have this dance that they do. And then I get them, and I'm trying to figure out what they're thinking, and then change that to, you have to sit there and wait to see what I'm doing. And then you have to wait, retriever people, to see which way I'm throwing it. I'm not always going to throw it to the right side of my body or straight out in front. I'm going to throw it wherever I want to throw it. It's your job, dog, to watch. So if you want to hunt or compete later on, it's a whole lot easier if the dog, as a little guy, has learned, I need to focus and see where that thing's going because I don't know. Where if you always do it the same way, then they don't even look. They just run out there. And so then you have to remove that kind of thinking and try to now teach them to sit and watch and pay attention and don't make any assumptions. Don't make any assumptions about where stuff's going. Don't make any assumptions about how long you have to wait. You know, don't make any assumptions about whether, man, I have to bring it back or don't, whatever I want. And the minute they take my leash or collar off, I'm all done. Another assumption. Try not to impart things like that to your puppies. And I could do that. I could go on and on and on with a bunch of little things like that. But it was very helpful for those of you that are raising puppies. I know life is full and busy and it's hard to focus that much, but your dog is focused that much unless you teach him not to. So be aware of the small things that you do and exactly what it is you are communicating to your dog. And if you want things to be easier on both of you as you now advance in after 6-7 months into the force fetch and the more, you know, the more challenging, more demanding stuff, you're going to make it a lot easier on them if they already know how to cope and deal and think and stuff like that. And for those of you that go, I don't want to do that, so I have a trainer. I'll send them over to Joe Schmo and that may be easy for you, but it's going to be a lot harder on that puppy. Somebody's got to go in there and change. And some people are good about it and some people aren't very patient. And so just be aware that assigning that to a trainer, your dog ultimately pays a price, whether severely or just, you know, harder than it needs to be. They're going to do that. So I would raise my puppy as well as I can, whether I was going to train it or have someone else do it. So those are my puppy thoughts on that. Now, not to go too long on these things, I'm going to talk about setting up your training plan for your 4-time Grandmaster title. And it's mid-June right now. So we have mid-June to mid-July and August. So you have 2.5 to 3 months to get these dogs ready to go run the stuff. Now, at this point, at mid-June, it would be very helpful if you had a dog. Your dog should point naturally without being hoisted and punished and all that kind of stuff. I don't know how to teach people to get their dog ready when they don't do that, so I'm not very useful there. But your dog should be, it doesn't have to be rock solid steady right now, and that's part of what you're going to work for. The dog should be a very good retriever. The dog should, at this point, already understand that it has to sit and wait, not be a crazy wild dog. It should be force-fetched and collar-conditioned, so you have the tools. And it would be, if it needs to have been, be going through the yard right now or coming out into transition. In other words, you need to have gone through the double T stuff where your dog learns to go on back and to stop on a whistle, and then also through the swim by or water force, whatever you hear, because a dog will handle on land, will go and stop, does not mean it will do the same in water. Water is different for a dog than land. It is not just transferable. If it were, then none of us who do this for a living would put dogs through swim by. However, everyone who does this for a living puts dogs through swim by, because that's how you can make sure that your dog understands getting into the water, staying in the water, stopping on the in the water, and taking casts in the water. And casts in the water are not the same as casts on land. It is a different thing. It is perhaps in a lot of our minds just geometry. Hey, I throw my left up hand up 45 degrees. Land or water, you take 45 degrees. And it doesn't exactly work that way in the dog's head. And most casting things, particularly on a dog new in the water, is either a get out or stay in cast in the mind of the dog. And people really do not understand that. Those of you that have difficulty in the water and go, what's wrong with this darn dog? It's probably not the darn dog. It's probably that you two are speaking different languages. So you need to have a plan right now. For one, and I know it's summer and I know it's hard, but doing upland birds ideally once a week, and I understand how difficult that is, you still have to do it. If you want to go through this and have a real pointer that does the real things, that doesn't look bad and have people go, really, you call those pointers? Then you need to do birds. That's just the way it is. And all those dogs that do really beautifully and consistently are very comfortable and very familiar with birds and are very real. So you need to plan for bird work. Locating birds, paying somebody to keep them, doing whatever you can. That's going to be important. Make sure you have the tools you need. Make sure your dog is force-fetched and collar conditioned. Make sure that you either have already done or are doing the yard work things successfully. And the work should be very good. And I'm not just saying that because I do it for a living. I guess I do it for a living because I always felt that way ahead of time. Make sure that when you say back that you know how to teach the dog it must go without brutalizing it. Teach the dog it must go. You have to teach go before you teach stop. Now, I know everybody likes a remote sit. That is just a big deal to everybody. They got to sit. It's very hard to teach it. And then let me see if I can explain this. When you teach sit, particularly with pressure, right? And ultimately, whether it's a rope and then collar pressure, all right? A dog relieves the pressure, the training pressure, by sitting. Whether it's, again, with a rope or a collar, most of it, people use both. So you first teach a dog, so they're out there 50 yards from you, and you blow that sit whistle, and you can enforce, and they'll sit, right? Oh, I got the sit. So now you're going to come in and try to get the go. In other words, when you say back, they take off with a lot of conviction that they should go, right? What pressure are you going to use to make them go? What is the pressure? So the way you conventionally do it is, you know, again, it's based off the force fetch. You have ear pinch or whatever you do, maybe a stick pressure, and then electricity. Well, when you've taught them that when you get electricity, you stop. And now you're going to try and teach them, well, when you get electricity, you go. Sometimes that is really difficult. One, you better really know what you're doing. I don't really know how to do that. Done thousands of these dogs, and I don't know how to do that. It isn't hard to teach them the go part, if you do it correctly, to then, starting with a rope, teach them to stop, and then you can come in with a collar pressure after that with a good, clearly understood program. But be careful about getting that sit before you get the go. A lot of problems you have with no momentum, not taking casts, just sitting there looking at you, and everybody thinks what's wrong with this darn dog, and it's the training program it's had that's confused it so much it doesn't know what to do. So make sure you have a program that makes sense to you, that also makes sense to the dog. And I would go, if you don't know, I mean, here I'm somebody talking, right? Who knows what I know? But if you go and see what all of the people who are consistently very successful, if you see the order in which they do things, do that. Do what works. That's, if you're not sure about trusting anybody, when you see the same thing over and over by the really good people, and when I say over and over, you know, I'm meaning not three times, 30, 300, stuff like that. People who really, really know what they're doing. Do that. Do it on land, and then have your plan to do it on water as well. Water is different for dogs. And I don't care, you can tell me about Old Fang, who never had any of that and was fantastic. You know, there's an exception to everything I ever say. But again, everyone who does this for a living does this one by. Find out where you can use a corner. There's a lot of ways, but you have to do that. If you want to go, you were getting your 4X, right? So find a way to do those things. And then, of course, you always, with retrievers, have to practice multiple marks and marks. Most of all, marks. Steady on marks, steady on stuff. So we have these different components. The first thing you have to do on your training plan is mark these out and go, all right, I need to have upland birds. I need to make sure that I have all of my fundamental tools in place. I need to make sure that, you know, I've got the handling thing where this dog is very clear. I need to have a place to do it in the water or enforce, you know, practice the stuff that I've done in the water. And I need to be able to have a dog that marks well. Do not, and I've said this 100 times on these things, go out and practice the master setups. That is not a teaching thing. That is a testing thing. Again, you don't learn algebra by taking algebra tests. So what you learn algebra by learning the fundamentals and practicing them one at a time. Make sure your dog is steady on marks, can mark a hard single well. Make sure that they don't head swing. Make sure that you don't have them making assumptions. Like I said with the puppies. Oh, every time we come out here, there's always a double and a blind. I'm doing a double and a blind. I've had dogs like that in for training, and when they had to do a double blind, they can't do it. It's like, I only go once. That's how this works. So make sure you have the individual pieces of this. So you need all of those in place at the same time, and you need a dog steady in the upland field once the pointing is consistent, so that you get the pointing there, and then you have the steady pieces of that, which is dechase and wheel breaking, or however you do it if you have another way of doing it. So we have all of those put together. Right now, sit there and break these down and assess where your dog is and where your understanding of these things are. So before you start doing stuff to your dog, say you're like, well, I've heard about this T thing. I kind of hacked my dog out on some blinds. It seems good enough to me. I don't really know what this is. So before making assumptions that, oh, my hacking them out just by doing it over and over again works, go find a good place to learn what this handling fundamental things are on land, normally called the double T. Some people use baseball diamond. I don't. But like I said, find out what all the people who are routinely and consistently successful do. And go learn about that. And then learn, before you do anything with your dog, go make sure you understand, how does this work? You know, when you look at it, so they're standing there and they're facing them face to face and they're doing this. So why are they doing that? Don't go through the motions. Don't watch somebody do it and then just go try it out with your dog. Because you have to, when you're doing those things, instantaneously respond to your dog's response to you. If you put your hand up and say something and they don't go, why? Is it because they don't understand? Is it why? You have to know. And if so, what do I do? How do I get out of this situation? You have to have a very good fundamental understanding of that. You can't just watch somebody and then go do it. It doesn't work because your dog may be in an entirely different frame of reference, entirely different thought. You've taught them an entirely different thing and they're going, I have no clue what you're doing. And then you really get after them and now you make this handling stuff a bad, bad place. And it's a lot better if you make the handling stuff kind of a challenging, fun place, like a chess game, you know, or a video game that's kind of fun. But you have to really understand things. So line these out. Find out where you are on all of them. Maybe you're strong on all of them. Great. Which one's the weakest? Where do you need to do the work? How in your life and your schedule do you have a way to begin to design the program now to work all of these things for the next 2 months? How are you going to do that? Believe it or not, you need to do that. You need to, if you know, we're looking for your 4X, right? We want to sail through this stuff and feel really good about it and have you and your dog have a lot of confidence. So this early sit down and think work is real important. How are you going to get your upland done? And what pieces of that, how do you do that? And then handling on land, handling on water. And I'm just going to I'll get into more detail on the next other podcast when we go a little more into detail on this. But for example, handling, I'm just going to say this. Dog needs to go when you say back. Dog needs to stop when you blow the whistle. Dog needs to remain seated until you cast. And that shouldn't be in one half a second after you stop them, because they're going to spin around 360 degrees and then keep right on going. Teach your dog when I say go, you go. And teach your dog when I say stop, you stop. And it may be 2 seconds. It may be 8 seconds. You wait until I cast you. Just like on the Bubby thing, when you take the leash off, doesn't mean go wild. Until I tell you, okay, now go ahead, you're free. So when I tell you to stop on a whistle in the land or the water, same clarity, same simplicity. You stop until I give you a very clear cast. So that whole puppy approach that I talked about in the first part of this podcast is the same thing we want to carry right here. Simplicity and clarity, and don't be in a hurry. And if you're scared, it means you don't understand. So get where you understand things and can slow down and take the time. So that's the beginning of the let's get our 4X training program thing going here. And line it out, find out where you need to spend your work, most of your time. Make sure it's balanced, because all those in one day, that's a tough thing at the APLA test. And map out how you're going to be able to accomplish this over the next 8 or 10, 12 weeks. Okay? And so everything is good. I made it through the Ironman, as you can tell. Goodness, that's quite an experience. So thank God. I will say this. I got one of the best coaches on the planet and did everything he said, even if I wasn't always sure why. And it took the time. Eminently worth it. And I think in the dog world, do the same thing. Do the very best you can. Follow a good program. Only way to go. So we will continue through the next series of podcasts to talk about that, getting your 4X training program. And if you guys have questions or anything like that, please let me know. Meanwhile, I hope everybody has a safe and wonderful summer, and I will be back soon.